Welcome to the Guild of Dads podcast, the place for dads into self-improvement, or as I like to call it, dad-proofment. My name's Joe Horton, and I'm going to be your host for the next hour or so as we go on a journey of discovery. On each episode of this podcast, I deliver to you conversations that will expand what you think is possible for you across many areas of life. I'm also going to delve into some tough and interesting subjects so you get insights and a different perspective to take away with you. I do this by speaking to fascinating individuals, best-selling authors, entrepreneurs, and ultra athletes, professors, psychologists, anthropologists, and also some ordinary dads like you doing some amazing things. Let's face it, none of us get a handbook when we become dads. We have to learn on the job. But being a dad represents a golden opportunity for personal growth and reflection about who we really are. Because daily our kids shine a light on every nook and cranny of our personalities. If you're anything like me, you're searching for information about how to be a better, more capable, competent, effective man and father. A role model your kids can look up to and demonstrate a life to them where you yourself are growing, thriving and learning new things, acquiring new skills and knowledge that you put into action. But it goes deeper than that. When you thrive as a man, everyone around you benefits and the ripple effect is immeasurable. At its core, this is what Guild of Dads is really about. So I'm going to ask you a simple question. What would your life look like if you could get your mental health, physical health, relationships and self-improvement in optimal shape? All at the same time as showing up as the best dad you can be. Think about that. Then write it down. There are a few ways you can get involved with Guild of Dads. You can listen to this podcast first and foremost, but you can also follow me over on Twitter or LinkedIn. I've already started a monthly dad's hike this year for 2 hours every month, which is free to join, set amongst the beautiful backdrop of the Ashdown Forest in West Sussex. 1 hour outside of London. You can also grab a copy of my book, The Dad Blueprint, which will fast track you free straight into our private Discord community, the Guild of Dads Brotherhood. To get this, go to dadblueprintbook.com. That's dadblueprintbook.com. To join the monthly hike, or if you simply want to reach out, shoot me a DM or drop me an email to joe@guildofdads.com. Today on the Guild of Dads podcast, I'm joined by heart surgeon, medical director of Ovadia Heart Health, and author of the book, Stay Off My Operating Table, Dr. Philip Ovadia. As some of you know, I lost my dad after he had two strokes back in 2015 and have a family history of heart disease. There's a good chance your story may be similar to mine in one way, shape or form. But in the aftermath of his passing, I found good information on diet and health difficult to come by. The advice from my GP brief, to say the least, and a ton of conflicting information. What I couldn't reconcile in my head is that a lot of people were shunning conventional wisdom and healing chronic conditions that they'd suffered from for many years, even decades. Which is why for some years now, I've been keen to speak with a heart surgeon, somebody who actually looks inside the body of someone with heart disease and can see firsthand the impact of how we live and eat, and more importantly, what we can do to change this. There's a ton of useful information in today's episode. Expect to hear how many of the people that Philip operates on actually have low cholesterol, why much of the information he learned during medical school has proved to be wrong, how it makes no sense to him that foods we have eaten for 99.9% of our existence are suddenly bad for us, the measures of metabolic health you should focus on to reduce your risk of heart disease, and a simple test you can have done to indicate whether you are in fact developing heart disease right now. And now to my conversation with Philip. Philip, welcome to the Guild of Dads podcast.
Great to be here with you, Joe.
Likewise. It's a pleasure to have you on here. And when I first linked up with you on Twitter, I actually, I think one of my sort of the things that I first said to you was, I wished I'd had a conversation with you around about 7 years ago, and then there's good reason for that.
Yeah, I think all too often people come into contact with me what may be considered too late, For many of us, you know, even if we've had some problems, which we'll get into, there's still room for improvement and recovery. Unfortunately, for some of us, that opportunity never comes. I view my message as one that the earlier you hear it, the better.
Definitely. Now, I'm going to kind of just give listeners and viewers a kind of taste of where I come from on this, and it will probably help kind of set the scene as to, it's probably the kind of journey that a lot of people go on with this. So back in 2015, I get a phone call out of the blue from my stepmom on a Tuesday morning, I think it was, to say that my dad had had a stroke. He'd been rushed into hospital. The stroke had affected the movement in one side of his body. I was still able to talk to him and he was still reasonably cognizant, but it had affected the movement in the whole of one side of his body. So we sat with him for a day, kind of contemplating what the worst would be. And the next morning we went into the hospital and it turns out overnight he'd had a second stroke. And the conversation with the doctors was, look, your dad's body is going to start to shut down. We don't know how long it's going to take. And it turns out that it was that day that he passed away. So later on in that day, I held his hand as he slipped out of this world. So in the immediate aftermath of that, the question that was on my mind was, well, hang on a minute, what does this mean for me? And the reason I asked that question was because of my grandparents. I think three of them succumbed to strokes, after some of them quite quickly, some of them over a period of months, years, you know, the after effects of it. And one of them from a heart attack. So there's a history of heart disease in my family on both sides. Both my mother and my father's side. So I go down to my local doctor and they say to me, and I say, look, can you check me out and just make sure that, you know, that I'm okay and whatever and stuff. And so they run blood, they do the usual things. And they're like, look, your heart, because I was reasonably fit anyway. So they said, look, your heart rate's pretty good. Your blood pressure's good. They ran all of that on me. And then they kind of got to the bloods. And they were like, oh, okay, your cholesterol is a little bit on the high side. And I was like, what does that mean? And they were like, it's not really that bad. I think they measure it differently in the UK to the US, but I think it was five. I think it was just over five or something. And I said, okay, so what do I do? And she said, just go away and look at your diet. So then I embark upon this next part of my journey, which is examining what diet means. And there was two broad schools of thought. One was kind of what the British Heart Foundation and a lot of the kind of official guidance around heart health is, which is the kind of Mediterranean diet and low fat and saturated fat is bad and stay away from this and stay away from that. But then by accident, I discovered the kind of primal movement, if you like, which is paleo or primal, and they were talking about low carb and they were talking about inflammation and they were talking about stuff like cholesterol and the hardening of the arteries only being an issue if I think there was inflammation already present. So I begin to kind of delve into this, and what was kind of weird as well, Philip, was I was reading a lot of first-hand testimonials of people who had gone down primarily paleo and the primal route, and they were reversing, you know, chronic conditions. They were reversing diabetes, they were reversing autoimmune disease. They were going back to their doctors and they were coming off of their blood pressure pills and statins and stuff. And I'm just like, hang on a minute, this can't just be all like, and then I'm looking at the conventional wisdom. And so, but my point is off the back of a tragedy, there is so much confusion and conflicting advice around this subject. My first question to you is the conflict and the confusion and the different pieces of information, is that conducive to people living a healthier lifestyle, or do some people just think this is too much, I'm just going to carry on as I am?
Yeah, you know, it is quite unfortunate that we have, you know, the situation where people who want to take an interest in their health can, you know, have a hard time doing so because, you know, there is a narrative, I would say, from the healthcare system. And, you know, I think this is somewhat universal, you know, whether you're here in the United States or, you know, in the UK. You know, I hear this from people all over the world, quite frankly, you know, the message is largely the same. And specifically when you look around heart disease and cardiovascular disease and stroke prevention, you know, the message is all about cholesterol and keeping your cholesterol low, whether that be by dietary means or that be, you know, using pharmaceuticals. You know, the message is keep your cholesterol low and you will be all right. But over and over, you know, what I started noticing as a heart surgeon was that a lot of the patients that I was ending up operating on had low cholesterol, had normal cholesterol, had healthy cholesterol levels. Some of them because they were doing these things, you know, on the medications or doing the diet. Some of them just had naturally low cholesterol levels for, you know, other reasons. And yet they were still ending up on my operating table. And so I started to ask a lot of those same questions. And I started coming across probably a lot of the same information that you did. You know, I was introduced to the low carb movement by Gary Taubes, you know, the journalist and the author. Mm-hmm. And I happened to hear him speak at a medical conference. And it resonated with me for another reason, because at that time, I was a very unhealthy heart surgeon. I was morbidly obese. I was pre-diabetic. I had tried, you know, to lose weight and get healthy many times, and I'd have some short-term successes like people often do, and then I would gain back the weight and more. And hearing Gary talk and then reading Gary's books, you know, was the first time that I had heard this alternative theory, basically, about why we get sick, why we get obese. And by adopting his, you know, recommendations, essentially, and of course, much more information that comes behind it, I became another one of those sort of N equals one, you know, that you came across. I lost 100 pounds. I reversed my pre-diabetes, and, you know, I got in the best shape of my life. And then, you know, looking at what was at the root cause of the disease that I was treating every day, heart disease, I came to discover that it wasn't necessarily what I had learned in school. And it's interesting because, you know, we go to medical school, and one of the things we hear during medical school repeatedly is that half of the information we learn during medical school is going to be proven to be wrong. We just don't know which half. And despite as many times as doctors hear that and as many times as doctors say that, they really don't put that into practice because, you know, I learned that cholesterol was the cause of heart disease. There was no question about that, you know, as I was going through medical school and I was going through my career. And yet, you know, I was seeing all these examples that would seem to disprove that. And yet, you know, you couldn't question that. It was just basic fact. And, you know, doctors sometimes just say, oh, well, that's a one-off, you know, this patient is unusual, you know, whatever it is. But once I started kind of delving into this information, I just couldn't ignore the alternative, you know, the things that disprove that theory and the volumes of data we have. You know, you can go back historically, you can look at modern studies, whatever you want to do, you know, it's quite clear that cholesterol can't be the entire story. Maybe it's part of the story, but it's certainly not the entire story. And so, you know, but then you get into this kind of, you know, there are multiple competing hypotheses. And I would say that neither one of them has been proven definitively. So it gets very confusing for practitioners, and therefore it's even more confusing for patients. But the problem that I see with patients today, you know, from a patient standpoint, is largely the healthcare system doesn't believe that people can remain healthy. The healthcare system is geared towards treating sick people. And when you get sick, you come to us for treatment. And, you know, we have all of these, you know, whether it's surgeries or medications or whatever it is, to try and manage your sickness. But we don't talk enough about what you can do to not get sick in the first place. And even after you get sick, you get something like diabetes or high blood pressure. We don't talk enough about those treatments or those conditions are reversible. We can undo them. And a lot of it has to do with the foods you're eating. And when you start getting into that category, you know, when you start talking about, okay, I've accepted that I can be healthy. I want to improve my condition. Now, what should I eat? And again, you get into all these competing, you know, sort of camps that are out there about what we should be eating to remain healthy. So It is a big problem. It has led me to, you know, do a lot of the things that I've been doing, writing my book and, you know, my practice that I work with people on preventative health, in addition to still doing heart surgery. But I hope that we can more and more first get the message to people that you can be healthy, that it's up to you to take charge of your health. Your doctor isn't going to do it for you. The healthcare system isn't going to do it for you. Certainly the food and the pharmaceutical industries aren't going to do it for you. It is up to you to take charge of your health. And then hopefully we can start to get good information out there, more prominently out there for the people who really want to improve their health and take charge of their health.
Yeah. And it's interesting what you say about that, because I found that when I kind of started to sort of talk to people in the medical profession about this, and I said to them, look, okay, I've noticed that I've been doing that I've been following like a lower carb, higher fat, higher protein diet, because, and this is kind of where it gets not confusing, but sometimes, well, a lot of the time, actually, if you're following higher fat, it's going to be naturally higher in protein anyway. But when I began to speak to people about it, and I'd say, look, surely the evidence is beginning to change on this and stuff. A lot of them were actually saying, yeah, there is more and more studies coming out on this, but we don't think it's going to be for another 5 to 10 years before the conventional wisdom kind of begins to swing, the pendulum begins to swing firmly into the favor of kind of the new data that's coming out. What are the kind of main facts around heart disease that have kind of been totally debunked in the last few years, Philip?
Well, you know, the first thing we need to recognize about heart disease is that it remains the number one killer in the United States and worldwide. And that is despite the fact that all of these recommendations, you know, the dietary recommendations, lowering dietary fat, that has been the recommendation here in the United States, you know, for 50 years now, and worldwide it has rapidly spread. The medications to lower cholesterol levels have been the most commonly prescribed class of medications, again, worldwide for 20 years. You know, maybe even 30 years now. And despite that, heart disease remains the number one killer. So those, you know, those sets of facts don't seem to match up. If your hypothesis is that cholesterol is what is caused, you know, is the primary driver of heart disease. So that's problem number one for me. And, you know, I now can accept the fact, you know, that cholesterol is not the primary driver of heart disease. Many other physicians, you know, do the same. Over there in the UK, Dr. Asim Malhotra has been a champion of this cause, and he has a book that came out recently. Dr. Malcolm Kendrick is another UK physician. Many other physicians, you know, here in the States and worldwide, but on the system level, you know, the British Heart Foundation, the American Heart Association, they still very much stick to that narrative.
I found this on the web.
And you know, it's going to take a lot to undo that. We have to realize that, you know, these institutions, these large institutions, may not have the proper incentives. You start to question as to, you know, what is their primary incentive? What are they trying to accomplish? Who are they sort of beholden to and answering to? And even outside of that, you know, it would just take a lot for them to admit that, you know, we were wrong. And we made a get, you know, we have to realize that the diet heart hypothesis, as it's called, the theory that, you know, the fat and the dietary cholesterol that we eat affects our blood levels of cholesterol, and that then causes heart disease. That theory, that hypothesis, which was put forward, you know, really for the first time in the 1940s and the 1950s. And, you know, there was a competing theory at the time that it was more related to sugar. And, you know, those two camps kind of fought it out, let's say, and the diet heart hypothesis won, and it became the prevailing hypothesis. But it never really was proven, you know, to an appropriate level of scientific scrutiny, I guess we can say. There was a lot of evidence against it, but basically that evidence just got ignored, and the hypothesis became the, you know, assumption. Basically, it was just became assumed that this was true, and you know, it got repeated enough, and it got picked up by enough of the large institutions and that drive policy. And so now you can't even step back and question it, even though it has never adequately been proven in the first place. So that's kind of the situation that we find ourselves in. And like I said, it's, you know, confusing for practitioners, and it's hard for practitioners to sort of break out of the mold and break out of that way of thinking. And therefore, it becomes very difficult for the patients, for the people out there to get out of that way of thinking as well, you know, because we have all been educated, you know, now most of us since childhood as to this is what you should eat. This is what's healthy. And when you tell people, maybe it's not, and, you know, maybe there's another way here, that can be very difficult for people to unlearn what they have been programmed with.
Yeah. And fat has been so demonized as well. I mean, because like even when you speak to young children now who, you know, they automatically associate fat with being bad. I mean, I'm that guy who kind of, you know, when we're having ribeye steaks, I'm that guy that when everyone cuts the fat off the rest of their meat, it all ends up on my plate and I eat it because I love it. But it's interesting how this, you know, fat has kind of been demonized at the same time as the low fat food industry has turned into a multi-billion-dollar and multi-billion-pound industry. And like, to give you an example of this, I went to the supermarket on Monday, and my eldest daughter wanted to get some yogurts, and we struggled to find a yogurt with fat in it. They're all low-fat yogurts. That's just one example of a whole section, a whole food type that is just blanket low fat. Like there's, it's actually quite difficult to find a normal yogurt now on a UK supermarket shelf. If you go for Greek yogurt, you can get it with the fat in it, but like most of the yogurts you can't. It's when you see that, you realize just how powerful this message has been embedded into our psyches, I think.
Yeah. And there's really, you know, an even more kind of basic assumption and more basic message there. And that is that the food that we have been eating for millions of years as we have evolved as humans is somehow now bad for us. So, you know, but people don't think about it on that level. But really what the message is that, you know, the the natural foods that are out there, you know, the things that are out there in nature are bad for you. And instead, you know, we need to create the food for you. We need to be processing it and controlling it and making it healthy. And that, you know, when you think about it that way, that's oftentimes one of the sort of baseline assumptions that I try to get people to understand. You know, does it make sense that the foods that we have been eating for 99.999% of our existence as human beings are bad for us and are killing us? And all of a sudden, you know, this food that we created, you know, in the blink of an eye in the last 100 years, which is, you know, really a minuscule amount of time, is somehow going to be better for us. And again, you know, it's okay to say we ran that experiment. And that's basically what it is. You know, this, the food pyramid, the standard American diet, the standard Western diet, you know, the my food plate, whatever form it takes, you know, that is an experiment. And we've been running that experiment now for, you know, 50 or 60 years, and it's not going well. You know, we are the unhealthiest we have ever been by almost any metric you can look at. You know, here in the United States, life expectancy has actually started to go down over the past 5 years, even pre-COVID. COVID, you know, sort of accelerated that. But, you know, we really need to stop and think about, you know, what is the implication of that and why is that? And we have to realize that we are unhealthier than we have ever been. And we, you know, the food that we eat is a major impact on that. So we have to start asking these basic questions. We have to really start questioning what is accepted as truth. And that is how we're going to start to, you know, right the ship here and turn the tide.
Yeah, I agree. And it's interesting because I before we came on this evening, I actually grabbed the website for the British Heart Foundation, and they talk about a balanced diet, and they make the distinction between things that you need plenty of, things that you need some of, and things that you only need a small amount of. So they say plenty of fruit and vegetables. Well, you know, that's kind of a no-brainer. Plenty of starchy foods such as bread, rice, potatoes, and pasta. Choose whole grain varieties wherever possible. Some milk and dairy products, some meat, fish, eggs, beans, and other non-dairy sources of protein. And then only a small amount of food and drinks high in fats or sugar. Now, there's quite a lot to take on there, but some of it's kind of quite contradictory as well, you know? Red meat's out, starchy foods, bread, rice, potatoes, and pasta is in. So,
yeah, exactly. You know, and again, we go back to, you know, what have we been eating as human beings for millions of years? And it was mostly red meat, and it was a little bit of vegetables and fruit. You know, the assumption that you need to eat a lot of vegetables and fruit to be healthy, I question that assumption, you know, because when we think about it on an evolutionary standpoint, we didn't eat a lot of vegetables and fruit. You know, it was only available seasonally, depending on where you were. And it was available in pretty small quantities. And, you know, since we've been able to, you know, since sort of the introduction of agriculture and making these things more widely available, it hasn't improved our health. And when you look at the science behind, you know, eating vegetables and eating fruit, and the improvements in health that come from that, the only way that you can improve, the only sort of thing that is shown is that eating fruits and vegetables are better than eating junk food, eating highly processed foods, high in sugar. Yes, if you take those out of your diet and you substitute more fruits and vegetables, you're going to get healthier. But we don't have any studies that directly compare, you know, eating high amounts of meat to eating high amounts of vegetables. And, the evolutionary record, again, would suggest that, you know, that is not the case, because we were eating much larger amounts of meat historically. And you can go to recent history, you know, let's say 1900, when heart disease was essentially undescribed. We were eating a lot of meat. And then over time, you know, since then, basically the amount of meat consumed here in the United States, at least, and I think this is largely true, you know, worldwide, the amount of meat consumed has gone down over the past 50 years. And again, our health has gotten worse over the past 50 years. So you really have to start to think about, you know, something that we have heard our entire lives, you know, that you need more fruits and vegetables to be healthy. Is that actually true?
Yeah, it's interesting. Interesting. Because I think that's one of those things that people sort of think of as, like, for instance, I do. I think that of that as a no-brainer, that it's better to have more fruit and vegetables. It's certainly better to have more fruit and vegetables than kind of processed foods in your diet, that's for sure.
Right.
So, and in terms of like fat and saturated fat, we hear about good fats and bad fats and stuff. And like some people will probably think, well, I don't even know what trans fats are, or you know, what I've heard described as Franken fats, where they're so you know, hydrogenated and change from their, you know, their normal state. But talk to me about the different, you know, the different types of fats, and again how this has been, how this story has unfolded as well.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, again, going back to the 1950s, the theory was put forward that saturated fat in the diet was, you know, related to heart disease. And the original work, you know, really came, this was promoted mostly by a scientist by the name of Ansel Keys here in the United States. You know, we were dealing with a crisis around heart disease at that time. The president of the United States, while in office, had a heart attack. The incidence of heart disease had been rising astronomically, you know, and so there were alarm bells going off. And Ansel Keys stepped forward with this theory that saturated fat was the primary cause of heart disease from a dietary standpoint. And his original study, which was called the Six Country Studies, what he did was he graphed out six countries and their the amount of saturated fat that they ate and their incidence of heart disease. And he showed this nice straight line that the more saturated fat a country ate, the more heart disease they had. The problem was that Ansel Keys actually looked at 22 countries and he hand selected these six. And when you actually graph out all 22, there's basically no relationship. You know, you have countries like France, who at the time had probably the highest consumption of saturated fat, and they had the lowest incidence of heart disease of the you know, countries he looked at. And so he just ignored that data. And then, you know, he basically kept repeating that data. And, you know, study after study that he would put out, and then, you know, his circle of influence would put out to reinforce this, all, you know, kind of referring back to the original data and saying, well, look, this must be true. And now we know that that original data was not true. And in fact, Ansel Keys actually was involved in a very well done, you know, randomized controlled trial of saturated fat versus what we call polyunsaturated fats. And that study, it's called the Minnesota Coronary Experiment. And that study basically showed that when you substitute polyunsaturated fats, which these are vegetable and seed oils, these are highly processed oils, and you substitute them instead of saturated fat, that it did not lead to improvement in lifespan. It may have actually worsened it when you look at the data. And so what did they do with that study? They basically chose not to publish it. The results came, you know, they got the results. They didn't publish the results. The data was only sort of rediscovered about 30 years later, you know, in the 1990s and early 2000s. And it was published at that time. And they went back. Ansel Keys had already died, but one of his co-authors was still alive. And they said, you know, why didn't you publish this data? And he said, we were disappointed with the results. So these are the things that have gone on. You know, this is the foundation that this whole theory is based upon. And we see problem, you know, and then it just, again, it became sort of a runaway train because the American Heart Association adopted this theory and they heavily promoted it and it spread worldwide. And, you know, then the food industry got involved and created all of these low-fat foods. The pharmaceutical industry got involved with medications to lower cholesterol levels. And, you know, here we are. But to step back, you know, I kind of deviated from your original question. There are three main types of fats that occur that we can consume, you know, that we consume as part of our diets. There are what are called saturated fats, and these mostly occur in animal products. Mm-hmm. They're sort of natural fats that occur in animal products. You have polyunsaturated fats on the other side of the scale. And these are mostly, you know, these mostly occur with processing. They come from, you know, they're called vegetable oils. They're really seed oils that are heavily processed to isolate these fats and, you know, create things like canola and, you know, vegetable oil and soybean oil and sunflower oil and things like this. And in the middle, there are what are called monounsaturated fats, which, you know, actually occur to a large degree in nature as well. You know, olive oil is probably one of the highest sources of monounsaturated fat. And these are generally recognized as healthy. And the saturated fats are generally recognized as unhealthy, although it's, you know, really, you have to question the science on that. Yeah. And then these polyunsaturated fats are now promoted as heart healthy. You know, many of them have the heart healthy label on the diet. And really, the only thing that polyunsaturated fats have been proven to do is to lower blood cholesterol levels. They've never really been proven to prevent heart disease or extend life in any way. But it's just assumed that because they lower cholesterol levels, you know, going back to the diet heart hypothesis, then they must be good for us. And that, again, is where, you know, the science breaks down. But we need to step back and say these polyunsaturated fats, these PUFAs, as they're called, these vegetable and seed oils, which are highly processed and have only been introduced into our food supply in significant amounts, you know, in the past 50 to 70 years. And again, during that time, what has happened to our health? It has gotten worse. Mm-hmm. So you really should be questioning that narrative. I advise people to avoid vegetable and seed oils and to stick to natural fats, which are your animal fats, and then the minimally processed oils, the fruit oils, as they're called, you know, which are things like olive oil, coconut oil, and avocado oil. Yeah. And I believe, and many others believe, that those are the healthy fats that we should be consuming. But that is very opposite the mainstream messaging.
I'm just going to jump into the conversation quickly here. I'm pretty excited to let you know that I have a Discord community running alongside this podcast exclusively for dads called the Guild of Dads Brotherhood. If you are a dad into self-improvement and you want to get the accountability, camaraderie, and resources of being amongst others on your dad-improvement journey, then this is for you. It's an insane one-off £5 to join, and you also get a copy of my book, The Dad Blueprint, along with a bonus called Fix Yourself, Fix Your Marriage, and a stack of other tool resources to get you started on your dad-improvement journey. Want in? Head on over to dadblueprintbook.com and jump on in today.
Interesting. And in terms of these kind of the different types of fats, there's an interesting point that you make, that it's important to separate the cholesterol question from the saturated fat question, because I think what's happened is they've all been merged into this one thing, that sat fat and cholesterol is bad for your health. And this is where the waters have kind of got muddied in this whole discussion, haven't they? Whereas, like you said just then, if you separate the two, the polyunsaturated fats, they might reduce your cholesterol, but the impact and the relationship between cholesterol and heart disease is tenuous, to say the least.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, going back to that diet heart hypothesis, there are really two parts to that hypothesis. The first being that the, you know, amount of cholesterol, dietary cholesterol that we eat, the amount of saturated fat that we eat is going to influence our blood cholesterol levels. That relationship is not entirely clear. And then the second part of the hypothesis that having raised dietary cholesterol levels, specifically what we call LDL cholesterol or bad cholesterol, then, you know, leads to heart disease. And as we've talked about, that part of the theory has not been definitively proven. And there's much evidence to suggest that both sides of that theory are not true. Yet, you know, the whole thing is very well accepted. And, you know, you have things like if anything lowers your LDL cholesterol, it must be good for you. And again, those are things that I think we should be questioning more.
Yeah. Because the thing is people picture this idea of LDL cholesterol and this kind of this fluffy tiny things that stick to the inside of your arteries go hard, and that's what causes a narrowing of the arteries and clots and all this kind of stuff. But
Well, actually, I was just going to comment on that. You know, it turns out that there are two types of, when you look at LDL cholesterol, it turns out that LDL cholesterol is actually sort of a class of cholesterol molecules. And there are two subtypes in there. There are the large fluffy ones and there are the small dense ones. And we know that the small dense ones are the ones that, you know, contribute to heart disease. And I don't say that they cause heart disease. They contribute to heart disease. And if you have damage to your blood vessel walls, these small dense cholesterol particles can then, you know, get involved in this, in the formation of these plaques. But the reality is that, you know, you have to, again, step back and say, we can't say that all LDL cholesterol is bad because it clearly isn't. And, you know, just looking at that one number really doesn't tell you enough of the story. And then, as we also mentioned, you know, inflammation, things that damage the blood vessel walls are really what, you know, start this process. And so if you really want to get to the root cause, you have to say, okay, let's figure out what's causing the inflammation. Let's figure out what's damaging the blood vessel wall in the first place. And if we can stop that and we can, you know, reverse that, then that is going to have a much more powerful impact on heart disease risk than the cholesterol is. And again, we have many studies that show this. It's just that most doctors haven't been educated to think that way. And this is not the message that, you know, most people hear.
You took the words right out of my mouth, because I was going to segue on to this next part on inflammation. And while you're talking, I'm going to just picture this in my head as if and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but the way I picture it in my head is that if there is inflammation in the vessel walls, that is almost acting like, like Velcro. You know, like Velcro stuffs. You have the two sides of the Velcro, and they have to, and you have to, and the hook bits stick to the other bit. And so, would it be accurate if I was to use that analogy that the vessel walls, if there's inflammation in them, they act like one side of Velcro, so the cholesterol can kind of stick to it, and that's what causes the issue. So actually, what we're working on is actually to remove one side of the Velcro so that the cholesterol flows in the bloodstream quite happily down the blood vessels without getting stuck to the vessel walls.
Yeah. You know, and you know, a little bit better way I would say to think about it is that, you know, those sort of hooks, they live just under the lining of the blood vessel wall, but they're normally basically covered up, so that they don't get exposed to the blood and to the cholesterol. And it's only when you damage that lining of the blood vessel wall that now these hooks are exposed, and then the cholesterol can go and stick to it. You know, the way that I oftentimes describe it to people is, you know, if you kind of bust a hole in your wall and you damage the wall of your house, you're going to take, you know, some some plaster to repair it. And if you keep damaging that same spot in the blood vessel wall, and then you keep putting plaster on it, eventually you got this plaster now sticking out of the wall. And, you know, that's basically what's going on in our blood vessels.
Okay.
So you could say, okay, well, I'm just going to, you know, try and use less plaster to repair the wall. And maybe that will work a little bit. Maybe that will slow the progress. But what it makes more sense to say is, let's stop damaging the wall. Let's stop poking holes in the wall. And then we won't need all this plaster in the first place. You know, we have to realize that cholesterol is essential to human life. If you don't have any cholesterol, you know, you won't be able to survive. Our blood, the walls of all of the cells in our body, you know, have cholesterol in them. Our brains have some of the highest concentrations of cholesterol in them. Cholesterol is vital and is present in our blood all of the time. So yet we don't like all immediately develop heart disease, you know, when we're born or early in life. It's only later in life, after all of this repeated damage to our blood vessels, that we start to develop heart disease. So, you know, I think it's more important, and again, we have a lot of data to support this, that it's more important to control the factors that are going to damage your blood vessel walls, rather than being focused on trying to lower the cholesterol levels.
Now, I'm going to move on to specifically sugar and metabolic health, because this is a kind of logical follow on from it. But it's very rare that I have sitting in front of me a man that has seen the inside of a human body. Can you describe to us, when you're opening up someone's chest and you're looking inside their heart and you're looking at the insides of their arteries and stuff, can you describe to us what it looks like looking inside a healthy artery that's not inflamed compared to an unhealthy artery that is, or where there is evidence of inflammation there?
Yeah. So, you know, and I'll, I guess,
it's a difficult what I'll question say is, to you know, answer, isn't it? I know. I appreciate that.
No, it's just that, you know, I don't get to look at healthy arteries because those people don't come to me for surgery. Although there are some contexts, you know, that we're doing other things to the heart, let's say, and the heart itself is generally healthy and I get to see it. But even within the blood vessel, you know, we should realize that these plaques, these blockages, they don't tend to affect the whole blood vessel. They tend to affect areas of the blood vessel. And then I'm oftentimes working on the healthier areas. Maybe they're not perfectly healthy, but they're at least healthier. And, you know, the basic thing that you notice is a healthy artery is nice and soft. It's, you know, it's subtle. It can expand as needed. Whereas when the artery gets damaged and this plaque starts to build up, you know, it becomes hardened and it's stiff and it won't, you know, expand and contract like it's supposed to. So, you know, we can certainly see that in the operating room. We can see evidence of that, you know, from scans. And this is one of the things that, you know, gets into trying to detect this early. You know, one of the hallmarks, one of the things that builds up in these plaques besides cholesterol, which is what we're also focused on, is calcium. And that calcium can actually be seen on CAT scans. And so there is a particular type of CAT scan that people can get that will show the beginning stages, the early stages of heart disease, before it becomes a clinical problem, before you have a heart attack, before you're having chest pains. And unfortunately, that scan, it's called the coronary artery calcium scan, does not get used as commonly as it should. And it's a scan that I advocate for, you know, people to get, because rather than looking at the blood and trying to guess about the patient's risk of developing heart disease. I would rather know that the patient has heart disease or they don't have heart disease. And if they have heart disease, you know, we can detect that early on before it becomes a problem and start to make some of these changes that are going to be beneficial. So that's just sort of, a little side thing that I'll mention, that, you know, coronary artery calcium scans are a very important scan to get. And unfortunately, most doctors don't use them as much as we should to try and detect these problems early before, you know, it's a major problem that you're now coming, you know, to me for me to open up your chest and try and fix the problem.
And if you have a history of family heart disease or you're concerned, what age would you suggest that it might be worth having one of those done?
Yeah. So, you know, I generally start recommending them to people in their 40s. And that is a little bit young. The more general recommendation is probably in the 50s to 60s. Mm-hmm. But the reason that I'd rather get the study early is, again, so we can detect very early in the process. What I tell people is that if you're very young and you get this scan, then understand that that's not, you know, as much of a long-term guarantee as if you're older and you get the scan and you have no heart disease. So, you know, we know, for instance, if you're in your 60s and you get one of these scans and your score is zero, you have no calcium in the arteries of your heart, over the following 10 years, your risk of developing heart disease is 1%, maybe even a little less. So it's very low. If you're 40 and you get this scan and your score is zero, you know, that's good. But I tell people it's probably not as much of a 10-year guarantee and you might want to repeat it earlier, you know, 5 years, let's say, I think would be reasonable. But, you know, again, maybe even earlier for some people, because one of the other things I can tell people is I now operate on people in their 30s and 40s on a fairly frequent basis. And that's a big change from, you know, when I started my career 20 years ago. When I was, you know, 20 years ago, when I started my career as a heart surgeon, it was almost unheard of for us to be operating for, you know, atherosclerotic heart disease, blockages in the arteries in people who were in their 40s. And now it's pretty common. So, you know, given the environment that we're in, you know, from a food standpoint, given how unhealthy we have become, it may not be unreasonable if you have, you know, concerns about your metabolic health, if you have strong family history, if you've been a smoker, you know, if you have diabetes, maybe it is, you know, it wouldn't be unreasonable to get one of these scans even earlier in your 30s. And let's find out, is heart disease developing or is it not? And is it, if it is, if it's developing that early, if you're in your 30s and you already have a score that isn't zero on a coronary artery calcium scan, that's a major red flag that you need to start making some changes so that you don't end up with, you know, significant heart disease by the time you're 50 years old.
Interesting. Significant changes is, again, a good segue into our next bit. Sugar, metabolic health. You talk a lot about metabolic health. And to these laymen that are listening to this, what the hell does that mean?
Yeah. So, you know, at a basic level, metabolic health means that your body is able to properly process the inputs that you were given, primarily the food that you were eating. And, you know, when we eat, one of three things happens to that food. Some of that food gets immediately turned into energy, you know, to fuel all of your activities. Some of that food gets broken down and used to build and rebuild tissues, a process that's always going on in our bodies. And then some of that food is supposed to be stored as energy in case there are times when, you know, energy isn't available. And again, on an evolutionary time scale, looking back through our history, there were often times when food wasn't available to us or wasn't readily available. We had to go out and hunt it down, literally. So We developed this system that we could store some energy and get through those periods. And then, you know, we would burn that stored energy, and then we would find some more food, and we would eat, and we would store some more. Our modern food environment has largely eliminated the problem of, you know, not having food available, and starvation has become, you know, pretty rare, thankfully. But we now have the opposite problem. We end up storing too much energy, and we never give our bodies a chance to, you know, burn that stored energy. And that has a whole host of downstream consequences, things like diabetes, which damages the blood vessel wall, which then leads to heart disease. So that is what metabolic health is about. In order to assess your metabolic health, I tell people, you know, to start with five basic measures. And these are the very basic measures, but everyone should know these numbers. And those measures are, first of all, your waist circumference. So, you know, take a tape measure just above the level of your belly button and measure it first thing in the morning. And I'll apologize because I'm going to use all the United States units here. We'll have to do some conversion.
That's all right.
But for men, it should be less than 40 inches. And for women, it should be less than 35 inches. And then the next metric is your blood pressure. You know, again, you can get it checked at home. You get it checked at the doctor's office. You know, many pharmacies, you know, grocery stores, drug stores, you know, you can get it checked. And you want your blood pressure to be less than 130 over 85, and that should be without the use of medication. So if you've been diagnosed with high blood pressure, that is one of the indicators that you are not metabolically healthy. And it's oftentimes one of the first indicators that sometimes doesn't get recognized as such. Then there are, you know, three blood work measures that we look at. So, you know, you'll have to go to your doctor and get these checked, or in a lot of places, you know, you can order your own blood work. But you want to look at your blood glucose level. And again, we use different units here in the United States. Our cutoff for healthy, you want it to be less than 100 milligrams per deciliter. In the UK, many other places, they use millimole, and that roughly is about 5 millimole. Mm-hmm. That you want your blood sugar to be less than. And again, that's without the use of medication. So if you have been started on medication to lower your blood sugar, if you've been diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, that is an indicator of poor metabolic health. And finally, we do look at cholesterol numbers. But importantly, the LDL cholesterol, that bad cholesterol that is all most doctors focus on, is not one of the measures of metabolic health. There were two other numbers on that panel, the HDL cholesterol, the so-called good cholesterol, and you want that to be higher. That's why it's called good cholesterol. For men, you know, over 40 milligrams per deciliter, again, U.S. units. For women, over 50 milligrams per deciliter. And finally, we look at the triglyceride level. And the triglyceride level, you want to be lower, and you want it to be less than 150 milligrams per deciliter. So we look at those five measures are, you know, just the basic indicators of metabolic health. There are some more other things you can go beyond that. But, you know, just looking at those five, for instance, here in the United States, we know that as of 2016 data that we have, 88% of the adults in the United States did not meet all five measures of metabolic health. Only 12% of adults were metabolically healthy. And, you know, that is very concerning, because metabolic health is at the root cause of most of the chronic diseases that we face. Things like heart disease, many forms of cancer, Alzheimer's disease, stroke, kidney disease, all of these things are associated with poor metabolic health. So that's why it's so important to focus on your metabolic health.
And in terms of doing that, what would you, you know, we've gone into the kind of stats. What are the things that you recommend people really start to get a hold of in order to bring those figures down to where they should be? Obviously, keeping in shape is, you know, again, it's kind of a no-brainer, that one. But what other things would you suggest that people really do kind of hone in on?
Yeah. So, you know, first and foremost is going to be the foods that you were eating. And, you know, the simple sort of message that I give to people around what to eat is to eat whole real food. The things that grow in the ground and the things that eat the things that grow in the ground. So these are going to be your plant products and these are going to be your animal products. Elimination of processed food is probably the biggest step that people can take to improve their metabolic health. And, you know, that's probably, you know, 80 to 90% of the picture. If you just stop eating processed food, most people are going to get, you know, vast improvements in their metabolic health from doing so. The other, you know, concepts to think about, the other principles to talk about are things like getting enough movement throughout your day, getting enough activity, getting enough sleep, very important for metabolic health, and dealing with your level of stress, basically. You know, I don't talk about eliminating stress because we all have stressful lives. You just need to be able to deal with that so it's not, you know, doesn't become a problem for you. Because stress can directly affect metabolic health if it's not appropriately dealt with. So, you know, those are some of the basics about improving your metabolic health. My book, which is called Stay Off My Operating Table, goes into it in a lot more detail, goes into each of those things in more detail. But, you know, if you just start with the elimination of processed food, eating whole real food, that's really going to get most people most of the way.
Yeah, interesting. And one thing I was going to ask you, and this kind of came up, and it might be an area that, so when I was looking into it, one of the things I noticed was that quite often in terms of kind of cardio exercise, and kind of endurance exercise. One of the things that I noticed that came up quite a lot was endurance athletes spending a long time in what they call anaerobic or red line, where they're generating a lot of lactic acid and a lot of inflammation post exercise, etc. And one thing that struck me was a lot of guys were advocating actually training a lot easier in terms of their cardio workouts, so level two, so you're aerobic rather than anaerobic quite so much. And I also saw some studies around kind of, you know, marathon runners in this, you know, final miles of a marathon and microscopic tears in the lining of the heart and stuff. What do you think about that? Because a lot of people really do enjoy endurance exercise, but one of the things, so my dad was a keen cyclist, but he also was a smoker and he also enjoyed a drink, but mainly one of the main things was he was a smoker. But he was, in terms of like cardio, he was doing, if you looked at him, you'd say, yeah, he's a fit guy, but he was doing quite a lot of hard exercise, you know, and it's always played in the back of my mind whether or not that is a good, because again, it's not what our ancestors were doing. They were spending large amounts of time walking and probably lifting, but they weren't running or cycling for 4 or 5 hours at a time, you know?
Yeah, exactly. You know, there is some concerning data around high-level endurance athletes. Now, for the vast majority of people, you know, the answer is get more activity, because most people don't get enough activity. But, you know, it's certainly there is some concern when you get to those very high levels of activity. And you're right, the inflammation that may occur, the demand that is putting on the heart can be a concern. You know, I usually take a step back with people. And when it comes to activity and exercise, there are two concepts that I think that are important for people to understand. The first thing is the more muscle that you can maintain as you get older, not only will that help you to live longer, but it will help you to live better. Your health span will improve. And again, that's something that has been shown many, many times. So I always tell people, prioritize building and maintaining muscle when it comes to your, you know, exercise or your activity time. And then if you have, you know, more time and you want to do some cardio, you know, I think that's fine. But, you know, you probably don't want to push it to those high levels. And again, most people are never going to get close to those high levels. So understand that for most people, the answer is just move more. But yeah. What I tell people is, you know, try and get more activity throughout your day. If you go to the gym, or, you know, you do that, you know, hour of cardio a day, and then you sit around the rest of the day doing nothing, you know, you're at your desk and you're, you know, sitting around on the couch watching TV, you know, you're not going to get a net benefit from that. Instead, if you just try and get more activity throughout your day, you know, I tell people, you know, if you have a desk type job, every hour, get up, take a little 10-minute walk. After you eat your meals, take a 10 to 20-minute walk. That has very powerful implications around your metabolic health. If you can be standing up, you know, while doing your work, get a stand-up desk and things like that can really have a major impact without having to go spend the hour or two at the gym or, you know, dedicating that hour or two to endurance, you know, cardio-type activities.
It's interesting because I look at some of the people that I know who have lived to a long age, and funny enough, my step grandmother passed away early on in the year, she was 103. Yeah, 103, just imagine that. But I sat there listening to one of the relatives speak at her funeral, and one thing that I always like listen for clues and stuff and that. And he was talking about the fact that she always kept her mind active. She was always moving around. She was always doing stuff. She led a life of moderation. So rather than kind of excess, it was, and it's interesting. I see some of these, some older guys as well. You know, I some of the guys that have got this longevity, again, are these guys that have kind of moved. Again, they're not necessarily doing hard workouts, but they're moving, constantly moving around. And I think there's an interesting, I'd love to, we won't obviously know for a few years' time, but I think it's going to be interesting to see when they begin to compare the people that were born in the, you know, the early part of the 20th century before World War II, when they begin to compare stuff. Because like, I remember like my grandparents in the older generation, they were like, what's all this stuff like pasta and rice and that? Because they were brought up on meat and veg, you know, that's what they ate. And it's just very interesting that generation have got quite a few, you know, centenarians that are now passing away. And you can't help wondering whether or not that is going to be the case as we go, as that, you know, as the generations kind of move on, you know. It's just something you notice when you're looking around yourself. And one thing I notice as well, I was on Twitter the other day, and one of the guys on there, a guy called Ed Lattimore, mentioned about the obesity in the US, and I kind of quipped to him that, you know, we're maybe not as bad in the UK, but we're not far behind you now, I don't think, in terms of kind of catching up. And when I go out of a weekend with my kids, I see a lot of people who are kind of as wide as they are tall, you know, and they don't walk. They waddle like this. And sorry if you're a waddler and you're listening to this, but I see a lot more people just out and about who are like that now.
Yeah. And, you know, one other important thing to understand, though, is that it's not only, you know, obesity. You can be non-obese, you can be a normal weight and be metabolically unhealthy. You know, in that same study that I talked about, that 88% of the adults were not metabolically healthy, when they specifically looked at the normal weight population, less than half of those people were metabolically healthy. It was like 45% were metabolically healthy. But that means that more than half of the non-obese people are not metabolically healthy. So you can't assume just because you're not obese that you're metabolically healthy. And again, when we look at countries, for instance, like India and, you know, China and the Asian countries, we see that they have very high incidence of heart disease without obesity. But, you know, when you look at those people, they are metabolically unhealthy. They just don't get the outward obesity. So it's pretty, you know, I always caution people that don't just assume because you're lean that you were metabolically healthy, and you really got to check the metrics and look into your metabolic health to know whether you're at risk for all of this other stuff happening.
Yeah, that's something I learned, that fit doesn't equal healthy.
Right.
And you only have to go to, like, coming from a cycling family, you only have to go to like a cafe or whatever with a group of cyclists in it and see the amount of Coke, cakes,
right,
everything that's getting shoved down. Because again, if they've been burning the anaerobic end of the spectrum, they're going to get to a cafe and they're going to be ravenous for those kind of things. But one thing I noticed was when I was doing more level two training is that you fancy a cup of tea or a drink when you get home, but you don't get that ravenous hunger that you get when you're going into the red all the time. Which is another whole other discussion in itself.
we might have to save that for part two.
Yeah, definitely. Philip, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you, and it's like I said at the outset, it's a conversation I wanted to have 7 years ago, because it's such an important subject for people to learn about and kind of educate themselves on, because it's a subject that's going to affect, it's going to impact most people, I think, and I think that I hope that one thing that people take away from this conversation is that if something does happen to a relative of yours, to actually allow yourself to reflect on your own life and your own kind of mortality a bit, because I think that's the journey I went on, and I think the journey that you've been on as well in your own path of discovery on this. So I appreciate you coming on and speaking to me about it. Where is the best place for people to find out about your work and what you do and link up with you, Philip?
Yeah, so you can go to my website, which is ovadiaharthealth.com, mm-hmm. O-V-A-D-I-A, hearthealth.com. And, you know, kind of all the stuff I have is there, my book and my podcast. And on social media, I'm most active on Twitter. And on Twitter, I'm at iFixHearts. So you can certainly find me there. And, you know, my name is not that common. So if you just type Ovadia into, you know, your search engine, you'll probably come across me.
All right. Super. And I'll link up all that in the show notes as well. I'm going to ask you one last question before you go on your way. And it's one that I don't prime any guests for. Philip, what is it in life that gives you meaning?
Yeah, so for me, you know, the most meaning certainly comes from my family. My children and my wife are really the why that I do all of this, why I chose to get healthy and kind of went down that path. And then ultimately, you know, just getting this information out to people, helping people to understand that they can be healthy, and that they are in charge of their health, as we talked about before. That is really, you know, at the core of my mission and of everything I do.
All right. Love it. I love it. Once more, thanks for coming on. And I wish you all the best in your quest to help even more people on this.
Thank you, Joe.
Cheers. Thanks very much. If you want to find out a bit more about Philip, you can link up with him on Twitter. His website is ovadiahearthealth.com, but also check out his book, Stay Off My Operating Table. My hope is that you took a ton of info away from this one, not least the things you can do today to change the trajectory of not just your life, but also your lifespan and health span. More on the subjects of health span is going to be in upcoming episodes. If you enjoyed today's episode, the greatest compliment you could give me is a rating or review on either Apple Podcasts or Spotify. I've just noticed there's a great new feature on Spotify where you can actually ask me questions as well. So if there's questions that you want to ask me, by all means, drop those in.
underneath the Spotify episode. I may also be dropping some polls as well under recent episodes, so you can so I can find out a little bit more about you guys that are listening. Also, share with friends or relatives you think may benefit. And don't forget, look me up and follow me on Twitter and LinkedIn. Thanks for listening, and I'll catch you next time.